The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hello, this is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Mike LaVar.
I'm Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Damian Sassauer.
Coming up on the show, we look at private equity in sports, and we'll talk with David Abrams, founding partner at Velocity Capital Management, about his firm and some of its latest investments.
I never knew this before, but there actually is a racing classification called the Sports Car Vintage Racing Association. Mm-hmm. And this classification is, if you own a classic car, you will go get licensed to be a driver, and you show up at one of our events, and you go on the track, and you race the same course where some of the most iconic races in the world are held. Indianapolis Speedway, Laguna Seca, Circuit of the Americas was just hosted, the Formula One, and you make your racing dreams come true.
We'll also check in on the ever-changing regional sports network landscape and how the Utah Jazz in particular are adapting.
That is all straight ahead on the Bloomberg Business of Sports. But first, we look at some of the latest sports headlines, including NCAA President Charlie Baker's proposal that would allow D1 schools to pay their athletes directly. We do that with Bloomberg U.S. sports reporter Randall Williams. You know him. Randall, man, welcome back to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I know we use the phrase all the time, landmark, blockbuster, game changer. But it's true that this is something brand new directly to the students, the school.
Yeah, Charlie Baker said that he would like to pay athletes $30,000 a year. So we'll see if it happens. It's the first time that he said anything like that. And this is all in an effort to keep college athletes not being employees of the schools and conferences that they play for.
Wait, explain that. $30,000 a year, but they would not be employees? What does the $30,000 cover then?
They're playing. I mean, it comes from a trust fund. So wherever the money would come from, whether that be the NCAA and its media deals or the conferences, things like that, it would be going straight to them.
And you would get $30,000 if you were, you know, a starting player versus someone who is sitting on the bench?
To be determined. I don't think that everyone, I mean, the idea of equality, I think, has changed so much because a lot of these schools, whether it be schools and conferences, all the money comes from football and basketball. That's the majority of it. And so when you're talking about the gymnastics, whether it be men's or women's, I'm not sure. I don't think that Charlie Baker even knows what that looks like just yet. It's a lot of things that they have to figure out, and I think they want to get it done quickly before the election next year.
Well, Randall, I think one of the driving factors behind Charlie Baker's decision to do this now was, you know, gender equity, right? I mean, Title IX, you know, allowing female athletes to participate in some of the revenue that we've seen, you know, go to the men. And, you know, my question is this, right? All else being equal, I was reading through the statement. I'm trying to understand it. Is because different schools can pay their student employees at different levels, right? So, you know, you have an RA at a dorm or something like that. Maybe at Alabama who's getting paid more than the RA at Georgia. I don't know. But the point I make to you is that kind of what you're proposing here, that these are just other paid students, you know, and so different schools can pay them more or less, because that opens up a whole new realm of issues.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah. I think that it really ultimately depends on the sport, the conference, and the conference, and the media money that's coming through. I think when he's talking about this, it's supposed to ideally level the playing field, right? Because all these college coaches, all these colleges and conferences are complaining about collectives, these entities that are basically alumni associations that are designed to pay college athletes. The richer you have, the richer collective you have, the more that an athlete can make. And some would say it's not fair because of the fact that if you have a billionaire, he can bankroll your entire team. It may not result in wins, but it's going to result in a lot of college people who are very rich.
Right.
That's why you have Ohio State sopping this up like gravy on a biscuit, because they love this. I'm sure other D1 schools like it, but just like you said, the schools down the line, they're not loving it.
Yeah, I think for schools like Ohio State has no issue generating money for the most part. I mean, their collective, I think Ryan Day came out a couple of years ago and he said, you know, we need $10 million to keep our football roster. And they generated it. I mean, it's no surprise, but it's for the smaller schools. I mean, we're talking about mid-level schools who don't have the resources, and alumni base is probably one of the top five in all of America. So when you're talking about this, I think it has a bigger impact for the middle schools. I mean, I would say the ACC now, because the Big Ten is as big as it is. The SEC is as big as it is. Even the Big 12, for example, is kind of a little bit smaller than those two conferences I just mentioned in the Big Ten and the SEC. So I think it has a bigger impact for those than it does for some everybody else.
This just sounds like it's going to be a big mess for a while. How do they go about untangling this or figuring it out, or, you know, creating some rules for the road here? Is it Charlie Baker and, a team of handpicked associates? Is it the college presidents themselves?
And Scarlett, remember, I mean, like, you know, the NCAA is kind of operating on borrowed time here, you know? So, like, you know,
explain that. Why do you say that?
Well, I mean, look, there's been a lot of change. You know, there's been a lot of calls for changes. You know, quite frankly, the SEC and some of the big divisions have talked about getting together and just cutting the NCAA out entirely, right? So, I mean, it really comes down to, you know, I guess the existential question of who Charlie Baker and who the NCAA really are. No, Randall?
Whether they need to even be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that whether the conferences will say it out loud or not, they have the power right now to go around the NCAA. However, where they don't have the power is some of these media deals, because March Madness is a media deal through the NCAA, the same way the college football playoff is, which means they would have to let that expire. In reference to NIL, it's like you said, they are trying to get this done as quickly as possible, because I don't know if you all have seen some of the things that are going on at Texas A&M, but Texas A&M had this this collective, and they raised a ton of money. At least that's what they said. And so they beat Nick Saban a couple years ago as far as the number one recruiting class. Well, now the school fired its head coach. They owe him a lot of money. I want to say it's over $30 or $40 million, if not more than that. And some of the athletes there are now transferring out, saying they made it seem like we were getting these millions of dollars and we didn't get anything.
Right.
And so the NCAA is looking at issues like that and saying, oh, well, this is a perfect thing that we're trying to stop. However, there are a dozen examples of athletes who are taking advantage of the situation as well. I mean, one of the things that I'm fascinated by is Caleb Williams. Caleb Williams will likely declare for the NFL draft. But what if he decided to say...
What school is he at?
He's at USC.
Okay.
And he won the Heisman Trophy last season. He was projected to win it this year. The season didn't go as planned. And so what if he decided to say, I'm not going to go to the NFL draft. I don't want to play for the Bears. I don't want to play for the Cardinals. I don't want to play for the Patriots. So I'm going to transfer to Ohio State, demand $5 million in NIL money, play there, and that's just what he does. Right. There's the power in the athlete to do that. Now, is he taking advantage of the system? It depends on how you're looking at it. So there's a lot of things that the NCAA is trying to fix.
You know, and it keeps kids in schools, Randall. I mean, like, if you think about it.
Well, that's a good question. Does he go to class? Does he need to go to class?
Ask him.
I mean, does he need a degree at this point?
I mean, there's a guy, and this is I don't know if you all have seen this online, but there's a guy I went to a basketball camp with many years ago. His name's Seth Towns. He has gone from Harvard to Ohio State and now to Howard, and he's played 8 years of college basketball. He's the same age as me, at like 25 or 26 years old. Okay. And each one of these has been a scholarship.
Uh-huh.
However, could you say he's taking advantage of the system if he's getting his bachelor's, his master's, his graduates, all while playing college basketball? I don't know.
Wait, he's getting a graduate degree out of this as well?
He probably has more degrees than all of us.
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
Well, you know what? The smaller schools need to go to, like, Juan Soto and say, listen, you got a lot of bankroll. You can handle this. My goodness, man. I'd be remiss if we didn't mention Juan Soto. The Yankees, if you're a Yankees fan, you are clapping your hands right now.
Soto hits into the air to right field, sending Betts back at the wall. That ball is gone. Soto with a three-run home run puts the Padres on top 10-7. A bat flip for the ages. They come all the way back from a five-run deficit to take a three-run lead in the top of the ninth.
I just wonder what Steve Cohen is thinking right now with the Mets.
You know, we re-signed Judge this year. When I say the New York Yankees. Sorry about that. But I think, it's going to be interesting. I mean, this is 1 year, $30 million, I guess, rental is what the Yankees are doing here. And they gave up, you know, some pitchers for it. They gave up King and some other pitchers. So, you know, we'll see if it works out.
Yeah, there's no we in Tigers. Oh, I'm sorry. We're people, too. Come on, man. We need to get somebody. Come on, Tigers. It's like, you know, between this and the Pistons on a nice losing streak, I don't even want to get weird.
Yoshinobu Yamamoto. That is the next. He's the big domino. I mean, good luck getting him.
Randall Williams, man, you are the man.
And thank you.
Thank you so much, man, for crying in my shoulder.
You interviewed Barry Sanders a couple of weeks ago, and the Lions won. I mean, they lost on Thanksgiving, but they won last week. I think you should be grateful.
Off play action. He's flush. He's hit. He got rid of it for a first down. Jared Goff with the play of the day, finding Jess Reynolds.
I think they're 9-3.
Yeah, they're
9-3 as of this right now. So I'm feeling it. Up next on the show, we speak with Bloomberg Global Business reporter Ira Boudway about how the Utah Jazz. They're experimenting with a new way of broadcasting games instead of the old cable TV news way.
It's basically kind of back to the future. For the last 30, 40 years, cable and the regional sports network in particular, which is how baseball, hockey, and basketball teams have distributed their games in their markets. They've made a lot of money with this regional sports network model, but it seems to be dying. And in the case of the Utah Jazz, their network actually died. And so they're having to figure out what's next.
That's straight ahead on Bloomberg Business of Sports and Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Welcome back to the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr, along with Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer. Ira Boudway has an excellent article that is in Bloomberg Business Week, and it is on the NBA's Utah Jazz entering their experimental post cable phase. First of all, Ira, thank you so much for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm thinking that I'm still modern because I have cable in the house. this is going to end, and it's bringing up a whole brand new business model on how sports teams are going to approach as they go out into the world and bring their product.
Yeah, it's basically kind of back to the future. For the last 30, 40 years, cable and the regional sports network in particular, which is how baseball, hockey, and basketball teams have distributed their games in their markets, they've made a lot of money with this regional sports network model, but it seems to be dying. And in the case of the Utah Jazz, their network actually died. And so they're having to figure out what's next.
And this is all due to people cutting the cord, not wanting these $200 cable bills because they don't watch half the things. And if they did want sports, then they can go directly to a streaming option, which is what the Utah Jazz are now offering. And a lot of this, Ira, has to do with the owner of the team and his new way of thinking about the business model of broadcasting his team's games.
Yeah, so the Jazz were sold to Ryan Smith, the co-founder of Qualtrics, back in 2020, and he's one of this new group of NBA owners who made their fortunes in tech. And Qualtrics in particular is basically an online survey software company, and so he is used to kind of figuring out the experience first for the consumer, for the customer, and the business model later. So that's the approach they're taking in Utah now. He's put games on free TV on an over-the-air antenna network, KJazz, and he's offering a subscription streaming service that's showing the games also, plus all this other behind-the-scenes programming they're going to build. And the idea is, as he puts it, you know, if he can get this stuff in front of as many people as possible, then they will figure out how to monetize that, you know, in time.
Well, Ira, I mean, like, let's just go there because, I mean, congratulations. The article's so awesome. But the awesome for me part of it was how local it goes, right? And you said Back to the Future, and that's the best analogy for what's going on here because you've got Travis Henderson and his team of 35, his night game crew. Basically, the only reason that the Jazz are able to do this as quickly as they can is because they do everything in-house to begin with, right? They even sell their own media rights. So talk to us a little bit about how the Jazz uniquely are equipped to do this, given their small market, you know, kind of presence in town.
Yeah, I mean, they are a perfect petri dish for this. They were vulnerable because they're in a smaller market. And so once the cable numbers started to erode, the number of subscribers, they, you know, it fell apart quicker. But on the other hand, they were used to doing these things themselves. They have, for decades, had their own production crew for games. So they were just handing off fully produced games to their cable partner in the past. So that means they don't have to figure out how to ramp up production. They were also selling their own advertising inventory in the past. So they now just keep doing that. So they were largely a do-it-yourself shop. They even used to own KJazz, the station that they now show their games on. That their previous owner, Larry Miller, bought that, changed the name to KJazz to put Jazz games on it. So they are just returning there to what they used to do. So they were really primed for this. They're just kind of now adding on this layer of a streaming service in the style of, you know, so many that we see now, Disney Plus, et cetera.
Well, this all really started for the Jazz. Back in 2020, the Jazz, they signed Rudy Gobert, and they had the big old contract. It was simple. 5 years, $205 million, and they said, okay.
Simple.
We're going to do this simply because we're going to, you know, the fees are going to be passed on to the cable provider, mm-hmm. and then the cable provider is going to pass the fees on to us. Everything is dandy. And then this happened when all of a sudden the regional sports networks went starting to go out of business. And there was a point 2 weeks before the season started where the Jazz did not have anybody to carry their games. And this really put the whole thing in motion.
Well, so they lost a bunch of carriage a couple seasons ago, right before the season started. So basically the AT&T Sportsnet is the Rocky Mountain, was their network. And when Warner Brothers merged with Discovery, they looked at the RSN business, including this channel and a few others they had, and said, this is a loser. We got to get out of this. And they tried to sell it, couldn't. So then they went to teams and said, we're exiting. You take back your rights and do what you want with them, but you're not going to be able to get more money from us. The Jazz, by that point, had already let their last deal expire. They'd sort of seen the writing on the wall and decided to go a different direction. So they were actually, you know, to your earlier point, well-positioned that way, too. They didn't have, like, half of a deal left when their network went out of business. But yeah, I mean, that model, while it lasted, was incredibly lucrative for everybody. You know, the Jazz were getting like $25 million a year from AT&T Sportsnet. And, you know, they were able to generate that kind of revenue because, as you mentioned, a lot of people were getting this programming as part of their cable bundle and paying for it as part of their cable bill, but not watching it. You know, so it was just a great gravy train. Yeah. But now that's going away, and you have to figure out how to, through ads and through direct to consumer services, how to make up that difference. And the Jazz have not figured it out entirely yet, right? They're not going to make the same money they used to be making right away. They think they will get there, but it remains to be seen.
So that's where I want to go, because this is not as profitable as it was. And the Utah Jazz, as you mentioned, have their own distinct advantages, smaller market. They already have a lot of this stuff in-house. They had the capability to just kind of go out there and do this. It'd be a lot different if you're talking about a somewhat bigger market.
Right,
yeah. The number of games that they play is reduced.
Yeah, I mean, so the NFL does not have to worry about this because they're just not on regional sports networks. And they are what drives national TV nowadays. But for Major League Baseball, this is a big, big problem because it's an even bigger piece of the pie for them. It's just they depend on these regional sports networks.
A lot more games,
yeah,
a lot more inventory.
There's a huge number of games, and really that's where the audience is for them in aggregate. They're not as much of a national TV presence. So,
well, the Minnesota Twins have already come out and said this is impacting payroll, right? I mean, and this takes me to the point, right? I mean, Ira, I just have to ask your thoughts on this. You know, $1.67 billion was paid for the Jazz back in December 2020. I don't know if Smith was under the belief that, you know, the Arsons would last forever, this game would go on forever, but he paid that number, right? And so he has to ramp back up as quickly as possible. Obviously, the subscriber service is one way. But, you know, K-Jazz is still, you know, they've still got, you know, I don't know, Wheel of Fortune on during the day, right? I mean, that's, I mean, if I'm wrong, right?
What's wrong with Wheel of Fortune, man?
I mean, look, I got it. I'm with you. I love Wheel of Fortune, you know, Pat Sajak. But, I mean, look, seriously. I mean, like, how do they expect to make up that shortfall? And what is the timing there? And will this, and this is really where I'm going, will this impact their ability to make those big name signings when compared to the Lakers, the Knicks, the Bulls, and the other teams that you know have, you know, in-house media and can afford to pay?
Yeah, I mean, they say that this will not change their payroll spending. And they emphasize to me that they have a pretty strong balance sheet on the other parts of the business. Ticketing is up, sponsorship deals are up, and so they feel like they can weather this. But if you look at sort of the actual revenue streams from their new model, it really isn't the streaming, at least in the short term. They've sold like 16,000 of those subscriptions at roughly maybe $100 a pop. So that is not going to be the difference maker, at least right away. What it is basically is now hopefully more people watch the games. And so far this year, you've got audiences up by about 40% because it's in more homes. It's easier to get.
Right.
Then you can sell those ads for more. So that's the biggest piece of the pie for them. And they think that'll take about 3 years, you know, as they new contracts get signed with advertisers to see those gains. The other piece is that, you know, a lot of people get their so-called free TV through a cable package. So K-Jazz at the moment is going to carriers, Comcast, whoever, and saying you can just basically have this programming because it's, you know, who's going to pay for it? It's like you said, Wheel of Fortune. But now they have Jazz games. They have some of the most valuable programming in the market. They can go back around and say, we need those retrans fees, which are just like your cable subscriber fees, where you're paying for each person who's getting that programming, you're paying a monthly fee. And once that happens, once you get those fees in place, the Jazz get a share of that.
So I'm thinking, you're right, because they have to show, you know, their growth, subscriber growth. They need to show their numbers. So you've been thinking 2 to 3 years, you know, then figure another couple of years, because things don't always go according to plan. Right. So figure 5 years would be a nice, you know, in the back of your head, you're like, okay, this sets me back 5 years. You know, I'm it's not like I don't have the money, but okay, fine. I got to make, I'll make ends meet, you know, and I'll pay Rudy Gobert.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the idea. Gobert, they offloaded to the Timberwolves, but same idea.
Same idea.
You got to pay your stars. I think that is basically the thinking there, that the balance sheet is strong enough. I think when you look across sports, it's going to be different. Bigger markets, the RSNs are going to be able to survive longer. Smaller markets, baseball teams, like we're saying, like you were saying, the Minnesota Twins, that's where it's probably going to show the most the soonest. Because when they lose their RSN deals, and in some of the cases, these are just sort of imploding. The league in that case has stepped in and said, we'll backstop you like up to 80%. Like, we're not going to just let this go into free fall, but that can't go on forever. Yeah. And it's still a come down. So those teams are having, the Padres, the Diamondbacks, the Twins, they are having to look at their payroll and make some hard choices.
It does, to your point. I mean, them releasing Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell, you got to believe they saw this coming down the road.
Yeah, I mean, there you could say maybe there were basketball reasons. You know, maybe they just wanted to start over with a rebuild. Things weren't working. Chemistry maybe was not in place. But yeah, it definitely makes you, I think, careful with your spending.
Ira, how healthy are the RSNs of bigger market teams like YES Network or MSG?
I mean, a good way to measure that in my mind is how much are they charging for their standalone streaming services. Mm-hmm. So if you look at like MSG, they—
Home of the Knicks and Rangers.
Yeah, they charge a lot, which tells me they don't really want this to siphon off from their cable business, mm-hmm. right? This is an offering that is really, they're not really yet to go full into it because they don't want to cannibalize their own business, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which means it's doing okay. And I think, you know, there is probably a lot of times when these businesses go into decline, that's a problem. But people think they're dead immediately, and it's not. It's, you know, it's a
decline. It's just long-term erosion. Long,
and it may hit a bottom where it coasts for a long time, and no one really knows kind of where that settles out. So we're starting to see the impact, but it's more at the edges.
I agree, Budway. Our own Bloomberg, and you, again, if you have our terminal, go and read the story on Bloomberg Business Week. I mean, it really is excellent, folks. And Ira just breaks it down. By the way, he had lunch with the owner of the Jazz, and we didn't find out what he ate. Ira, thank you again, sir.
I appreciate it.
Up next on the show, we dive into the world of private equity in sports with Velocity Capital Management co-founder David Abrams. That is straight ahead on Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Hello, welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports podcast, where we explore some of the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr.
I'm Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Damian Sassauer.
You know, we don't mess around when we do this show, because we always make sure to get the top-notch folks who know what the Sam Hill they're talking about, the movers and the shakers. Today, no exception. He is the founding partner of Velocity Capital Management, David Abrams. Thank you for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, to clarify for people out there, Velocity Capital Management, what is it all about?
Well, Velocity Capital Management is a private equity firm that my partner Arnie Reese and I founded 2 years ago. We are investing in companies at their growth inflection point across the entertainment, sports, and media ecosystem. We really strive to be a value-add, hands-on, both investment and an operating partner. Both Arnie and I have backgrounds in owning, investing, and operating a range of entertainment, sports, and media companies. And so, you know, in a bit of the traditional private equity model, we try to be very actively involved in the companies that we invest in.
So one of the new investments that you've made is in Pirelli Motorsports, which is the owner, the largest owner and operator of Grassroots Motorsports live events racing across North America. What are the growth opportunities there? How can people access this sport right now, aside from attending the event live?
Well, I must say, I really don't know much about motorsports.
You're learning.
And I had never been to a Grassroots Motorsports event before we started looking at the company. But what was amazing to me is the passion that our spectators and racing entrants had for motorsports. And the theme of the company is, we make racing dreams come true. when you go to these events and you see all of the participants and the spectators, you start to get a sense for how this is a business that has only started to reach its full potential. And the business is kind of a very interesting mix of intellectual property, which is one of our key investment themes. And so I never knew this before, but there actually is a racing classification called the Sports Car Vintage Racing Association. Mm-hmm. And this classification is, if you own a classic car, you will go get licensed to be a driver, and you show up at one of our events, and you go on the track, and you race the same course where some of the most iconic races in the world are held. Indianapolis Speedway, Laguna Seca, Circuit of the Americas was just hosted, the Formula One, and you make your racing dreams come true, right? And so it's an amateur sport, but the individuals who buy these cars and they fix them up and they bring their family and their racing team and they go out on the track and they're living a dream. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was not only is it quote unquote cool, but our partner Tony Perella figured out a way to create a platform out of this. So we've got the Sports Car Vintage Racing Association, which is really amateurs who own their classic cars racing. We also own the Pirelli Trans Am Racing Series, which has been around for 60 years. It's stock car racing. In some ways, it's people that had raced professionally in NASCAR or young up-and-coming drivers who want to be professionals. And then we also host the two lower levels of Formula One. Mm-hmm. So there actually are 14, 15, 16-year-olds who are aspiring professional race car drivers. And the analogy is minor league baseball, single A. Mm-hmm. Then you go from single A to double A to triple A and hopefully mm-hmm. the major leagues. I never knew that in Formula One, which we can always talk about the popularity and the growth globally, there are young individuals who aspire to be, whether it's a Formula One driver or a NASCAR driver, and this is where they get their start. So when I went to Circuit of the Americas, literally 2 weeks after the Formula One race was held, you know, we have races from 8 in the morning to 6 o'clock at night. We had, I think, over 500 different racing entrants over the course of the weekend, all these different racing classifications, all these different walks of life in a very kind of intimate and enjoyable setting. When you were asking me about, well, what's so exciting about this, when we look at these live entertainment businesses, this was a founder-owned business that had built a really good platform, but it was never run like you would say a traditional live entertainment asset like a sports team. Mm-hmm. So the intellectual property had not been monetized properly. There hadn't been a cogent content strategy, how you can distribute it, how you can create shoulder content and right. create interesting stories. So we looked at it as like a natural extension of what we do, but really we're working with an individual named Tony Perella, who's a bit of a quote-unquote legend yeah. in the grassroots industry. And it's a lot of fun working with Tony.
You're making this old motorhead just cry.
You know, David, Velocity Capital, I mean, when you think of a private equity firm, especially investing in sports and media properties, you think of performance, you think of process, pedigree, you think of people. And I think we have to take a step back. We have to understand the people at Velocity. We need to understand you. We need to understand how someone can come from UPenn, from Bear Stearns, DLJ Toiling, going through Apollo, European buyouts, and becoming the CIO of Harris Blitzer Sports and Entertainment and being an owner of Crystal Palace and, like you mentioned, you know, the Scranton Wilkes-Barre AAA affiliate of the Yankees. I mean, did you ever imagine when you were toiling at DLJ that this is where you'd be?
Definitely not. You know, I have three adult age children, and there's a little funny story because when they learned how to Google, my middle son came to me and said, you know, Dad, you're not, there's another David Abrams and he's more famous than you. And I tried to explain to him, you know, I had to burst his bubble that, you know, your dad's not Superman, so to speak. So to answer your question, I never envisioned to be in the seat I'm in. I really never thought that I would start a firm that, you know, had my name on it, so to speak, because I've always worked in larger organizations. But the different career paths I've taken have really set me up to be successful today. You know, when we think about what we're trying to do, you know, having really the first person at Apollo to ever start a business that was outside private equity and outside the U.S. And we built an amazing platform, and Apollo is a fantastic place to work. So when you're there, you think, well, that's where I'm going to be forever. That's all I'm going to do. And then when I transitioned out of Apollo and I started investing and operating a handful of these different businesses, it was before capital really started flowing in to buy professional sports teams the way it is today.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This was 2012, 13, 14. And I saw this unique, what I call disruption in intellectual property. Technology was starting to create ways for intellectual property to be further commercialized. And so I said, well, this is really what I want to do. And, you know, made a handful of investments with close friends and former colleagues. And, you know, I worked very closely with both Josh Harris and David Blitzer. And then when I moved back to the U.S. after 15 years in London, Josh and David had created Harris Blitzer Sports and Entertainment. Today, it's an entity which really is the largest owner of sports assets in the world.
The Devils, the Sixers,
you know, Joe Gibbs Racing, and then, you know, Crystal Palace is an affiliate, and obviously Josh is now taking control of the Commanders. And so I moved back to the U.S., and we kind of had this idea of you've got this incredible amount of operating insight from all these companies you own, because they're companies. How do we harness that intelligence to make better investment decisions? And obviously, having worked with Josh at Apollo or even David at Blackstone, that's what big firms do. What's your competitive advantage? So when opportunities would come into the organization prior to me joining, there really wasn't a conduit to actually properly underwrite them and make investments. So we set up a very integrated investment platform that leveraged all the deal flow and all of the intelligence of the employees and the assets globally. And it was really going well. And so there's a lot of challenges that everybody went through during COVID. And we came to the conclusion together that, you know what, we're close friends. We worked together a long time. It was the best fit for me to say, you know what, let me go start a business. I have all this connectivity and relationships with this broader organization. Love to have you guys as my, you know, limited partners, which they all are. Mm-hmm. And we set out to set up Velocity, you know, as I left Harris Blitzer Sports at the end of 21. But the last thing I'd say is, while I've never thought about setting this up, I also, in my wildest dreams, never thought it would be as hard as it is.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. Harder than the worst days at a DLJ, for instance.
Well, there were a lot of really good days at DLJ. You know, real quick aside, so I did work at Bear Stearns. I did spend a year at Bankers Trust before I went to DLJ. Then obviously DLJ, and then DLJ got bought by Credit Suisse, and then Credit Suisse doesn't exist anymore. So four of the firms I've worked at in my life don't exist anymore. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But DLJ was, you know, unbelievable business. And then obviously when we merged with Credit Suisse, it gave us a European footprint, and that really enabled me to start to move into the next phase of my career, moving abroad. And then when I went to London, I went to Apollo. But when I was raising my first Apollo fund, it was during the financial crisis. And I remember being in Tokyo for the first time. It's a wonderful experience. And I'm, you know, it's like lost in translation. We're walking around all night long. And the next day, Lehman Brothers goes out of business.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a challenging time to raise capital.
Yeah.
You know, it took us 3 years, got the first fund raised, and we built an amazing platform. You know, at the end of 21, as capital flow started changing and people realized the mistakes they may have made when money was really cheap, it's become very challenging for emerging startup managers to raise capital. It doesn't matter what your background is, what your pedigree is. There's just not a lot of capital. So we've done it, you know, in a way that I think is the only way, which is slow and execute on what you tell people you're going to do. And so with Perella, this is our, you know, fifth investment. It's a control deal. It's the exact microcosm of a transaction that we want to do. And this will hopefully enable us to continue to grow our capital base.
And you've got other investments as well, Elevate Sports, Video Cities, X Games, et cetera. You know, I'm curious, you mentioned capital flows. And, you know, how closely do you track some of the big capital flows we're seeing into new sports teams, or for that matter, these media licensing and rights deals? I mean, like, are you watching all that each and every day, and how do you track that?
Well, I definitely see the trends that are taking place. You know, when you think about private equity or institutional capital, right, there are a lot of really smart people. And what I always say is, if there's a good risk-adjusted return investment opportunity, capital pools will form to take advantage of them. And that's how the big alternative platforms have gotten bigger, right? You started with this creditor real estate or private equity, and you just migrated out and you brought experts in. So as institutional property has now become disrupted, it's being commercialized in a way where you have very consistent and stable revenue streams, the underlying asset becomes more valuable. Therefore, you can actually underwrite it from with an institutional lens. And so the capital flows that have come in, let's just pick sports teams first. The reason why larger pools were not investing in these assets, let's call it even 10 to 15 years ago, is they weren't big enough and they weren't really stable enough. In many cases, right. they were family-run businesses focused right. on a local market. As technology has disrupted the distribution of content, you've seen just simple evolution of sports betting becoming legal, which is a new sustainable revenue stream. Mm-hmm. You've seen innovation where, you know, the owner of intellectual property, meaning the team who has a ticket, now tickets can be distributed and repackaged in ways that couldn't be before with the advent of technology doing it on your phone. So all of this is happening at the same time that the value of the live event is only worth more because more people can now see it around the world, right? Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, you know, Scarlett's wearing her Rangers fleece, but if I wanted to watch a Yankee game as a Yankee fan, I'd watch, you know, one game a week on Channel 11 in black and white in my room.
Yes. Right?
Then, you know, cable was a disruptor. Mm-hmm. So when cable came in, you could subscribe to the YES Network, you could watch all the Yankee games, but you had to be kind of in the New York metro area. Now you can watch the Yankee game anywhere in the world, anytime you want. So by definition, that one game or piece of IP is worth exponentially more to the rights holder.
Right.
So if the rights holder, if it's worth more and it's got a stable revenue base coming in from sponsorship, you could see paying more for it because you can kind of forecast out what the value creation is going to be. And that's always the simplest example I give to why does everybody want to invest in sports teams? It's not because they're charging more for parking, which of course they do. It's not because your chicken tenders and fries, which by the way, are the best seller in America, they're going to charge you 30 instead of 20 bucks. It's because the value of the intellectual property, the ability to watch that event, is just worth more because more people can see it easier.
So how challenging is your job now with the collapse of the RSNs, right? I mean, Utah Jazz games aren't you can't get those everywhere on the planet, right?
You definitely can't, but you know, this is what creates opportunities, right? Where if I think about Perella, we in the past couple of years, we film all of our races, we put it on a platform called Mav TV. Nobody watches it. Nobody pays for it. Okay, so if you think about Formula One as an analogy, they created interest in the sport through a Netflix documentary.
Right.
You know, I lived in London and I'm a pretty big sports fan. I used to change the channel on Sky when they start talking about Formula One with Lewis Hamilton, like put on the football news. I don't care about racing.
What?
Right? It's true. You know, I lived there. I never went to Silverstone. I never went to the
continent. Was there when Lewis Hamilton probably won it 7 years in a row.
So, you know, just as someone who, you know, understands a sport and likes going to live events, I never did that. So when we think about how do you create excitement in your sport, right? It's all about the stories. And that's what gets us excited about grassroots racing because there are some great storylines. I mean, we have, I think it's 20 years of historical footage of the Trans Am Racing Series that's sitting in Tony Perella's house in Romulus, New York.
In 8mm.
Probably in 8mm. And don't laugh, in the X Games, which we were part of a group that carved the X Games out of Disney, you know, MSP Sports Capital led the deal, and my partner Arnie he worked there, he helped structure the deal, and so we were an investor in it. It's the same exact situation. So think about this. The Walt Disney Company, which bought ESPN many years ago, owned the X Games, wasn't what you'd call their number one asset.
Right.
And when they sold it, there was the equivalent of many, many years of historical footage of Tony Hawk back in the old days. Mm-hmm. That had never been digitized or monetized.
Right.
And so for us, those are opportunities because that is valuable intellectual property that you can now monetize and you can use that to create a more valuable business.
You know, you were talking about so many things involved with Mark Cuban, and we were talking about this before we went on the air, and your thoughts about, well, what is Mark Cuban thinking? It's like, and nobody knows except Mark Cuban, of course. But you had some interesting thoughts.
One thing I didn't mention, Michael, when we first bought the Yankees AAA team, we were on the phone with the local media.
Right.
And we went to their office, we went to Scranton Times, and we were with the local media. And I understood really well that as an owner of a sports team, you're really renting it, meaning it is a community asset. Your job is to be a good steward of that. Everything that means from winning, being part of the community, providing a fun experience, that's really your job.
right? When you own a bigger asset in big cities, right? It's a really big responsibility. Scarlett, we were talking about it. You know, it's emotional and it's a huge time commitment. And sometimes life is more important sometimes than owning a team. It's no different than owning a business. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to be an owner of a professional sports team today and to not be actively involved. Right. You know, it's funny when, you know, I was living in London, I was running the Scranton Wilkes-Barre Rail Riders, which is not easy to get to from London. And then I had Keymotion, which I bought and ran, which was a computer vision content capture business at a outside of Brussels. And I had three kids that were in high school and younger. And
you were pulled in every direction.
I was pulled in every direction. Yeah. And when we started thinking through about setting up Velocity, we had the opportunity to acquire more minor league baseball teams or sell our team. And I actually discussed it with my wife and I said, look, I can't do all this. Actually, she said, you can't do all this, but I kind of agree. So we made the decision as a group to sell, which was a sad day for me. You know, the Yankees AAA team, the Yankees were our partner. It was a lifelong dream. It's a whole nother podcast to talk about fun, some of the stories. But I learned firsthand that, you know, you're really, quote unquote, renting these assets. And we had to give them back to the community and make sure the team was set up so they could, you know, go on.
Yeah. The team outlives the owners or whoever is the owner at the time. So when you talk about professional investors like private equity firms buying into these different teams and monetizing the intellectual property, what kind of tensions arise with the other teams within the league? Because you've got some teams are owned by families and they have been for generations. And then you have other teams that are being taken over by professional managers who are looking at things very differently.
It's a good question. I was actually over at Major League Baseball. We were meeting with them yesterday about video sites, which helps rights holders, you know, capture their social media content and help commercialize it further. What I've typically seen is that most professional sports owners really collaborate because they don't necessarily compete, if you will. There is definitely a sharing of best practices. At away games, we'd go sit with the management team, we tour the building, we talk about different ways that we're driving revenues, different companies that we're seeing. So I think there's a lot of collaboration because the reality is you're not really competing, especially in a league like the NFL, where you don't even have local media rights. So the NFL sells the media rights and you're just really a game day, you know, focused revenue business. So I think the teams collaborate. And I think the leagues, now that the capital flows have come in, the valuations are so high, and you've got people with a professional investing background versus maybe it was a family-owned business for a long time and they never understood some of the best practices. That's the other part of it, why people are getting excited about owning sports, which is intellectual property, because the businesses themselves have a lot of opportunities to further commercialize them. And so you might have a new owner coming in who will call up another owner and ask them to help them on, well, what's the best way to monetize our suites, and hiring an outside firm to help us drive revenues. And that's actually the area of the market that we are very excited about. Yeah. Because if you just think about it, high level, all this capital is flowing in to acquire intellectual property, whether it's teams or leagues or events. What are they looking to do? How are they going to create value? Well, you got to start with revenue growth.
Right.
And when I first started at Harris Blitzer Sports, and we were talking internally and with some of our external partners, and that was the genesis for the creation of a company called Elevate Sports, which I saw firsthand. It was an idea on a piece of paper. And we started the business. Some interesting stories during COVID about how we kept it funded. We had a board meeting yesterday in Elevate, and the business is doing phenomenally well because what we are doing is we are providing basically advice and consulting services for owners of rights on how to better commercialize their operations, drive fan engagement. You know, we just announced we were working with the Tennessee Titans on their new stadium, right? So how do you position your suites? What's the best way to go to market for your naming rights partner and your other, you know, founding partners for the stadium? Everything down to what does the signage look like? How is it easy to get around the stadium when you have kids and they can't find the bathroom? Well, that fan experience actually matters. And so that's the modern day professional sports where you're leveraging organizations that have best practices. Think about it. If you owned a manufacturing company, you might hire Bain or McKinsey to help you think through strategy. Well, in today's world, with the value of these assets, owners of the intellectual property, they hire firms like Elevate or CAA or Wasserman.
That's a great way to describe it.
That's exactly what you've seen. And so with all these what I call smart people focused on these assets, more predictable growth revenue streams, that's how capital pools get excited.
Well, David, I have to apologize on behalf of Michael Barr. He gets upset when we talk about NIL because he blames Vice Chair of the Federal Reserve, Michael Barr, for stealing his NIL proceeds. So I apologize for that.
Proceeds?
Potential proceeds.
Well, he'll make money off his NIL. I don't want to say that.
But, you know, David, last question I have for you is, you know, I mentioned it earlier, the four Ps, process, people, really. And Velocity, if I'm not mistaken, you know, is owned by people. And there might be some changes in terms of the construct of the general partner. I'm wondering how much you can share with our audience on that.
Sure. Well, I answered the question before about how challenging this environment is to launch a firm. And I think it's always hard, you know, being an entrepreneur, but in this market specifically. So we have spent a lot of time thinking about, okay, how do we do this a little bit differently, right? Given the background that Arnie and I have, not only as kind of investors, we recognize the importance of having smart people around the table. And, you know, it took us a little bit of time and we had a lot of conversations, but we recently have finalized a transaction with a group called GDP Ventures, which is controlled by the Hartono family of Indonesia. And what's so exciting about that for us is, first of all, they are the nicest, kindest people I've ever met. Their global reach and some of their investments intersect perfectly with what we're doing. I'm going to give you an example. You're going to say, really? So the family acquired a Serie C football team in Italy a couple of years ago. Now it's in Serie B. The team's based in Lake Como. What could be a better place? They own a lot of the real estate around the area where the arena, where the stadium is, and they've been looking about ways to invest in it, build it out, further monetize it. And of course, during the conversations, I said, look, we have to introduce you to Elevate.
Yeah.
Everyone's excited about it. I go to Jakarta. I come back. Of course, I'm remiss in doing it. During our Elevate board meeting yesterday, I find out, because I got an update on something, that Elevate's already working with them on a feasibility study. And it just dawned on me that, yes, while we are trying to connect this stuff, my partner is already in the middle of a lot of things that we're doing. And so connecting some of the other investments they have, they're very active in the music space with a company called 88 Rising. They own content distribution platforms. And for us, having a partner that has operations around the world and, quite honestly, that are really good people because this is kind of a family – I couldn't be more excited.
Oh, David Abrams, you were so kind to come in and talk with us. The founding partner of Velocity Capital Management. David, thank you so much for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me again.
And another story we are watching. It was announced that Carlyle Group co-founder David Rubenstein is in talks to acquire the MLB's Baltimore Orioles. According to people with knowledge of the matter, Rubenstein is among suitors pursuing the transaction. Rubenstein's net worth is $4.6 billion, according to Bloomberg. And that's something we'll keep our eye on as it develops. David Rubenstein is the host of the David Rubenstein Show, Peer-to-Peer Conversations, which airs on Bloomberg Radio and Television. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports Show. We're here each and every week at the same time. For my colleagues, Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer, I'm Michael Barr. Tune in again next week for the latest on the stories moving big old money in the world of sports. You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.